rather fitting that we're talking about technology today, because earlier, before, at work, I felt like a character out of the movie Office Space, wrestling with a printer and wondering what PC load letter meant. I felt foolish. And technology can make us feel that way sometimes. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today. Larry returns tomorrow. And we're talking tech today with our guest, Beth D'Angelo. She's been in IT for more than 20 years and a senior IT specialist at UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. So whether it's your printer, your cell phone, or anything else connected to the interwebs, you can give us your questions today, because nobody's foolish with this. It's just hard to figure out sometimes how the wires connect. Cybersecurity, AI, join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email to talk@wpr.org. And Beth, welcome back to the Larry Mueller Show.
Good morning, Lee. Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, me and this printer this morning were not on good terms. And I felt, I don't use printers very often. And I feel like sometimes when you need them, that's where the struggle begins. And
yeah, of course.
When you're talking about connectivity, I go to the web browser and I go to print, and there it says save as a PDF, but I needed it to actually create a physical copy of something. And I didn't realize that I needed to go to a separate window to add the printer so that the web browser could find the printer so that I could get the sheet of paper.
Yeah, isn't that fun? yeah, sometimes the browser may not pull up your printer if it, I guess, depending on how the printer was installed and what drivers you use, the browser might not identify it right away. So adding those that knowledge to your browser to be able to print an actual physical document sometimes is real frustrating.
And we've got this amazing tech team that is always so busy on very complicated problems that I was very reluctant to turn to them to ask, how do I use a printer?
With your printer issues and you know that PC load letter error, the only way to fix that is with a baseball bat, according to Office Space.
So you are familiar with the sentiment.
I am very familiar, yes.
So June is Internet Safety Month, and last week with Michelle Ryan and Michael Domke from our Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, our consumer protection experts heard stories that just made me very wary about doing anything online, and yet we do everything online. So what are your basic first steps for June Internet Safety Month so that we can stay our safest when we're browsing the web?
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, something that, you know, we should focus on kind of every day in our practice, in our hygiene of using our online tools, but having a month to focus on it where we're really talking about it and bringing awareness to it, I think is really important. So the basics, first off, protecting your personal information online, your full name, your address, your phone number, passwords, information about where you work, things like that. You want to make sure that that information isn't easily found online, because sometimes that can be used for social engineering purposes to get information from you to compromise accounts. Using strong passwords, always one of the first things we recommend to people. So unique passwords that we don't reuse between services. Strong passwords contain alphanumeric and special characters, uppercase, lowercase. Change those frequently if you can. Use a password manager if you struggle to remember all these passwords you need to create for all those services. So a password manager tool.
Do you have a recommendation for a password manager that you use, Beth?
Yeah, there's a few different ones. LastPass is a pretty commonly used one. There's also Password Vault is another one.
What about when web browsers want to save your password information?
That I'd be, you know, it depends on the web browser. If you're using something like Chrome and you want to store a password to, you know, some sites that aren't keeping your financial or health record information or any of your real, like, personal data, I think it's okay to store a password in a browser. But, you know, I would hesitate to store any consequential credential information, so banking, healthcare, any access to your personal information like social security number or address, things like that. I would stick to a password manager that's separate from your browser. And those password managers actually have like browser plugins that make it a little bit more seamless. So it looks like your browser is storing it, so you don't have to go to that password manager for it.
Let's go to your calls for our guest, Beth D'Angelo, now at 1-800-642-1234 or email us talk@WPR.org. Ken and Brandon, good morning.
Hi. I'm constantly getting prompts on my phone, sometimes when I'm in the middle of doing something else. And Samsung wants me to upgrade to something called One UI. I think it's 8.5 or something. And I really don't want to do that because in reading the descriptions of this upgrade, I'm told that it more fully integrates AI and things like that. And I really don't want to do that. Is there some way I can get rid of these notifications?
Beth?
Yeah, that is the latest version of One UI is trying to automatically update on your phone. And I'm trying to find out if there's a way to disable that automatic update. It looks like if you go into the Samsung Galaxy Store app on your phone and you go into the settings of that app, you can choose a setting that says do not auto update apps. And that will stop your phone from prompting you to automatically update it. That way, when you want to update it, you can go in and do that on your own without the phone trying to do it for you.
But boy, Ken, we are seeing this more and more often with updates that would include the integration of artificial intelligence. And understandable
yep.
that there would be some reluctance there because it seems like you are feeding these large language models with things you may want to keep private. And since this is Internet Safety Month, trying to find that balance seems, Beth, to be more difficult every day.
Yeah, I agree. I think, and even if you did want to go with the update to get the other features that were included in it, likely there are settings then that you can go into within the iOS that will allow you to turn off the features that are AI related within the new update. So I would look into that as well. Maybe run a Google search on shutting off the AI on the latest version of the Galaxy OS.
So, and the other aspect of this is when I'm pushed these updates or encouraged to add these updates, and I think of the Windows operating system from Microsoft, they often say that they're security updates. And since June is Internet Security Safety Month, I'm reluctant to not accept the update because this feeling there is that I could be left vulnerable.
Yeah, that's the thing. They kind of strong arm you a little bit into yes. adopting these new features by packaging those security updates. When you get features and security in the same package, you're not going to want to disable that because you need those security updates to keep the secure posture of your device. So you're kind of damned if you do and damned if you don't.
Well, it feels like we are beholden to the operating system. If we're going to stay safe online, they've got updates for that, but there's a trade-off that seems to include the integration of what they want from you to some degree, and there may be buried in the settings somewhere the opportunity for you to have better control if you have the time and are going to accept the update. Figuring out how to turn off what you don't want may be worth it.
I think that's really the key is understanding what you're getting with that update and then taking a look at how you can protect yourself against any potential software that's changed or features that are added that you don't want exposing your data.
Ken, thank you for the call. When Ken's talking about the One UI 8.5 update on his Samsung cell phone, is that the operating system for the cell phone?
Yeah, that is the operating system.
So when we're talking about operating systems, that means that everything else is sort of working off of this basic structure?
Yeah, it's really like the UI stands for user interface. So
okay.
That's that front-facing interface that you see when you're interacting with your device. So it really does touch kind of everything.
The other thing that I've learned from you, Beth D'Angelo, is that when we're using cell phones and connecting to public Wi-Fi, that we are making ourselves insecure. Unless we are protecting that information as it goes through a public Wi-Fi, and a public Wi-Fi means that it could be available to anybody who has access to that router. Or explain this for me a little bit, because I had not thought before talking to you too much about connecting to a public Wi-Fi in order. I don't have unlimited data, so I can't just stay on a 5G connection at all times. So I rely sometimes on these public Wi-Fis, but I didn't realize that it could make me vulnerable online.
Yeah, essentially, when you are connecting to a public Wi-Fi network that isn't password protected, or maybe it is password protected and the coffee shop just has the password written up on a board mm-hmm. for everybody who walks in, anybody else who is connected to that network can then use certain tools to potentially infiltrate whatever device is connected to that network. So let's say your cell phone's connected to it and you don't have what we would call a VPN connection set up so that you are creating a secure tunnel around your traffic. Somebody with some know-how on how to sniff out that traffic and essentially hijack your connection through that network could then use it as a way to steal data from your phone, to compromise your phone, to install a virus, any number of things.
So VPN stands for Virtual Private Network, and it basically creates this tunnel that will limit what other people can see, especially if you're on a public Wi-Fi or somebody else's internet connection, because then anybody else would be able to tap into that information if they had the right software and access whatever you're doing, wherever you're going, and whatever you're typing in. That virtual private network I found on my old Pixel phone, Google Pixel phone's what I've been using for the last few years. And so the Google offers its own VPN, but doesn't that then mean that Google can see it? But I guess it's probably better Google than somebody that I don't know.
Yeah, that's the thing. You want to be careful with what VPN service you're using. Some are more secure than others. Generally, some of the free VPNs can actually be what's called a honeypot, which is a tool that may have some backdoor compromises on it for people to be able to they put a security tool out there, but the security tool is actually the vulnerability. So I would stick to some of the more reputable paid versions of VPN software out there. A lot of the like Norton and the Norton 360 product comes with a VPN package. So if you're already paying for like an antivirus, anti-malware software, you can also take advantage of the VPN software that comes with that package.
And for anybody that is using a public Wi-Fi, I would imagine if they are doing anything personal with that connection, they would want to employ some form of VPN that has been rated, that has been reviewed, and that has been given the okay, because that honeypot sounds more dangerous than a public Wi-Fi, Beth.
Correct.
Let's go to Alan in Madison next. Alan, good morning.
Hi, I used to live in Japan in the 90s, and they were way ahead of us. They were already shopping on their telephones back then, and I thought, uh-oh, wait till this gets to the U.S. So I helped all my friends back here, you know, create their first email address, and then cell phones came out, and I kept telling people, be very careful, you know, maybe don't use your real name when you sign up for things. I wanted to ask about the VPN, because I'm very careful about protecting my information, but a lot of sites won't let me enter the site if I'm using my VPN. For example, Amazon. And I also have a different telephone number I use for business, and a lot of businesses like BMO, Harris Bank won't let me use that online telephone number. Wondering if you could address those issues and any good workarounds you could recommend.
Thank you, Alan. So first, it is the VPN and sites like Amazon identifying that you're using a virtual private network and not allowing you access. Beth?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think that that would likely come from maybe a couple of different reasons. One being location. So when you use a VPN, you can usually choose the location that your connection will then look like it's coming from. And some services have a way of detecting, like internet services or online services like Amazon, they'll be able to detect where your internet traffic is coming from. And if it sees that it's coming from a country or a location that isn't allowed to that site, it'll block that traffic. So making sure that if you're trying to get a U.S. You enter a website that you are connecting through a US VPN link, and they'll give you in your VPN software a list of servers that you can use for connection and what countries those servers are in. So you want to keep those in the United States to be able to access stuff that is accessible from the US.
Which makes sense from the perspective of websites like Amazon, because they'd want to limit fraud themselves. And if they're seeing U.S. accounts coming from a VPN that appears to be a server overseas, that would throw up some red flags.
Correct. And then sometimes a VPN uses a different protocol for connecting. And I'm not going to get into the details of protocols because that gets real wonky. But that's also another thing that you can switch based on, you know, how you're connecting. If you're getting denied connection to certain sites, I would change the protocol settings within the VPN that you're using to make sure that you're not getting restricted because of that, because of firewall settings on the site side.
And Alan's other question was about having an internet phone number that he likes to use for things like banking and being shut out of personal accounts because it appears that this phone number is suspicious, I would imagine, in the same way that a VPN server location could be suspicious, Beth.
Yeah, I think that that is pretty typical in with financial institutions, that if they see traffic that comes from a VPN, sometimes they flag that as suspicious because it comes with different signatures than traffic that doesn't come through a VPN. And because financial institutions are really picky about what traffic they allow to hit their sites, you may have a little bit more trouble accessing them, especially with like an IP phone number. They want to connect a phone number to a device, not to an IP phone number.
So for Alan, is there a workaround for him when it comes to these phone numbers and his personal accounts online?
Yeah, but really the only way to get around the IP phone number, I think, problem would either be to use a burner phone that had a physical phone number, you know, tied to a SIM card. I think a lot of that is required because of regulation information. They need to know, they need to be able to track those transactions directly back to a physical device. So having a physical device linked to the telephone number usually will then get around those blocking issues.
A burner phone, Alan, that might be a solution. But you said SIM card before. Does that suggest that internet phone numbers don't have these SIM cards and physical cell phones do?
Yeah, an internet phone number is using an eSIM, whereas a phone is using a physical SIM card. You can use eSIM cards on a physical phone as well, and it may also cause problems with banking systems. So they're looking for that phone number connected to an actual physical device, because they need to know that that device was in a person's hand, you know, and is tied to a specific person.
What's a SIM card do?
Regulatory. It basically ties the physical device to a carrier who is then passing that data from your device to whatever site you're connecting to. So then they can trace the data traffic all the way from your device to the site you're going to.
Sounds like a level of security that may be useful.
Definitely.
Alan, I hope that helps, and thank you for the call. You can join our conversation. We're talking technology today, from internet safety to figuring out that darn printer. And whatever it is for you, whether it's AI, perhaps data centers, give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Send us an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. You know, it's hard enough staying safe online as an adult. How about the kids? Summer's here, or about ready to be. School's out, or it's about ready to be. So how can we keep our kids safe online? I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today. Our guest is Beth D'Angelo, who's worked in IT for more than 20 years. She's a senior IT specialist at UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. And you can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org. And Beth, let's take a moment to talk about what we can do to protect our children online and keep them safe. Are there some steps we can take that everybody should think about?
Yeah, absolutely. And some of the same things that we talked about with adults, as far as, you know, creating strong passwords and being careful about making sure your personal information is protected online. So not publishing your full name, address, phone number, school information, things like that. But as far as like social media habits, I think talking to kids about, you know, thinking before they're posting, thinking about the fact that whatever they put out there on the internet, it's almost impossible to get rid of. So once you hit send, there really is no way to hit unsend. You can't put the toothpaste back in the tube. So it's really important to talk to kids about thinking before they put something on the internet and understanding that those things can be permanent. Reminding kids that people online may not be who they claim they are. So, you know, it's very easy to hide behind a screen and a keyboard and claim that you are someone that you aren't. So being careful of that and, you know, not necessarily suspicious of people, but at least protecting yourself. And then how to respond to things like cyberbullying. What do you do if you feel like someone is creating a harmful environment around you or targeting you for cyberbullying? How to respond to that, how to block users, how to report harmful behavior. Things like that are really important to have conversations ongoing with kids about.
How does a parent engage in talking about screen time? How much is too much? I always thought that the best post you make on social media is the one you never post. That was kind of my rule of thumb. And then I got on Instagram about a month ago, and I, you know, they're nice of them to get to the bottom of my scroll and say, maybe you'd like to take a break from scrolling. And so I've thought about my screen time, but what can a parent do to intercede on a children's screen time if it's the middle of the summer and they're looking at their phone?
Yeah, I feel like, you know, it's hard to tell kids not to look at their screens if you're not offering them another alternative. So creating opportunities for kids to do things that don't require a screen to be in their hands, getting outside more, you know, enrolling them in activities that are more physical in nature, where they're moving their bodies and doing things like that, setting kids up with volunteer opportunities over the summer to spend their time doing more productive things than scrolling Instagram. I feel like kids turn to scrolling often out of boredom.
Yeah.
And offering them more engaging activities is a great way to keep them off their screens. When my kids and I are out doing things and really active, I don't have to tell them to stop looking at their phone because they forget they even have it with them because we're doing things that are way more fun.
Is there software that can allow a parent to somewhat control what their child's doing online?
Yeah, absolutely. There are a lot of tools out there that are helpful for parents. I use a couple of them. On the devices themselves, you can enable the parental controls. That allows you to have some semblance of control over what apps your kids can use. There are also, on the Apple products, there's something called Screen Time. On Google, there's something called Family Link, and then Microsoft has a family safety application. So all three of those kind of cover the gamut of mobile devices for being able to restrict kids' activity and the amount of screen time and how much time they can spend on specific apps. So maybe you don't want to like shut down their phone and turn into a brick entirely, but maybe you only want to let them have an hour a day on Instagram because any more than that is too much. You can set that up on an app-by-app basis.
Do you have a guess as to when the right age would be for your child to have social media accounts? I know my nieces have been pressing my sister for a long time, and I don't know when the right time is, or is there a stage of development that says it's okay? How do you assess that as a parent?
Yeah, I think, you know, the peer pressure to start, you know, on social media comes a lot earlier than it did, I think, in years past. And, you know, now we're looking at, like, you know, kids between age 10 to 12 are starting to really, like, you know, want to get involved in social media. And I think that many of the social media platforms actually have age restrictions on how young you can be to be on those. But then there are other things like, you know, you've got games like Fortnite that are marketed specifically to young kids that have social media components and chat components built into them, similar to things like Instagram and Facebook and Snapchat. So, you know, it's really about finding a healthy balance between spending time online in the virtual world and, you know, keeping your sights set on doing things in real life and, you know, spending more time in the physical world present.
Let's go back to your questions now for our guest, Beth D'Angelo, Senior IT Specialist at UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. And you can join us at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk at WPR.org. Joe and Jefferson, we'll go to you next. Good morning.
Hi, Beth. Thanks for doing this. As you can tell, people have a lot of questions about technology. So we appreciate you coming on. Yeah. I have a quick point before I ask you about AI, or a tip. What I've been doing for years, because I'm afraid of password managers, because if what if someone cracks that, right? It's kind of like the VPN, or, you know, you're trying to do something good, and that software itself might be the biggest thing you need to worry about. So what I do is put all my passwords on a note file on the desktop or whatever you make notes with on your phone, but don't put them in a row. So if your password's 67895, just put 12826789503, and then you make up patterns that you know, the gibberish numbers, so someone looking at this would never know. And then right near that number, you would put an initial of, like, Chase Bank, put CB. So no one would know it's Chase Bank and that where the, you know what I mean? So there's many ways, once you use that scheme I just gave you, to play with that. And make, so I have one text file I've been using for 20 years that has it all in there, and no one would be able to do any, have it backed up everywhere. So that's my solution.
So you've got, like, your own encryption that you're using for trying to kind of obscure the way you're storing passwords. That's clever.
Yeah, and on AI, I have a friend that knows way more than me about technology. He can write code and all this stuff. But I found that sometimes even high intelligence doesn't mean that you're going to maybe know everything, right? Like, people can be a little crazy that are super, super smart. And why I think he's a little off on this is he's saying, there's nothing to worry about with AI. We don't need regulation. This is all a bunch of mainstream media fear. And I'm like, what? I've never heard anybody say that, because everywhere you do hear that, all the reasons. So I was just wondering on your take on AI and how much we should be worried, because I did some more research after he said that. And there's so many different types of AI. And to think that there's nothing to see, that we're just, it's just a language model and we shouldn't worry. I know it's a big question, Beth, but I'll let you answer that if you can the best.
Yeah, so I think it's kind of a little bit naive to think that we don't have anything to worry about with AI, and it's not really all media hype, but there is definitely some, you know, catastrophizing, and it's hard to tell really what to be worried about right now because there's so much information coming at us. But I think some of the things that the federal government and some of the states have focused on as far as how to regulate AI is really looking at how AI interacts within specific industries or specific parts of industries. Things like hiring, medical decisions, insurance decisions, lending, education, to make sure that the algorithms that are built into AI aren't causing discrimination because they have patterns built into them that are going to kind of circumvent our human sensitivity to those issues. So there's a lot of regulation kind of being enacted right now to target those specific industries to make sure that AI doesn't really take the human element that needs to be involved in those out of it. But then you have concerns with, you know, is AI going to take my job?
Yeah.
How should I be retraining myself to use those tools so that I can keep up with where my industry is going? There are a lot of things to worry about, and it's difficult for regulation to get anywhere close to keeping up with the pace of technology. So the regulations are always going to be very far behind. The other worry I have is something like deepfakes, where AI-generated content is getting better and better and is becoming very difficult to determine what's real and what isn't.
Can that be regulated? We during the Consumer Protection Show last week, we heard stories of computer-generated voices sounding like grandkids who were pleading with their grandparents for money online. That was this online scam that appears to be exist, which makes it more common than I thought it could. And that seems to be like a deepfake that is looking to take advantage of people.
Yeah, there are actually a number of states now who've actually they've created criminal laws against certain AI-generated deepfakes, mostly related to things that are used to manipulate elections or to distribute adult content without consent. But it is starting to pick up now where states are looking into how can we regulate these deepfakes? How can we require the tools providers to label these in some way or watermark them? Or how do we make it obvious to people that what they're looking at is AI-generated content and not actual real imagery?
Charlie, I'm going to get to your question in a minute, but there are a couple follow-ups from what Joe brought up, and he brought up an awful lot. And sticking with AI here, I heard on Wisconsin Today just a couple of weeks ago about the UW-Madison launching their College of Computer and Artificial Intelligence coming up here July 1st. Beth, what do you know about how AI plans to be studied at in an academic setting here?
Well, I know that UW-Madison has, you know, that's been a part of the curriculum AI for many, many years. A lot of the, you know, early large language model development was done through the School of Computer Science at UW. So it's not new to our campus, but I think now it's really being embraced as its own area of study rather than a niche portion of IT or computer science. AI has kind of taken on a life of its own and gathered enough momentum to warrant its own field of study entirely at the university. So I think the focus is going to be on ethics and how do we look at integrating AI products into markets where it hasn't been used? How do we use these tools in research in other areas. So not just researching how to make better AI, but how to use AI in other areas of research. So I think it's going to be a really powerful organization on campus to take that up.
Where AI excites me is its problem-solving skills and things like complex math or complex structures. And because it seems to be, and I don't want to call it thinking, but it seems to be processing in a way that humans haven't necessarily thought of before, that it's coming up with new ways to approach problems that are offering some new and novel solutions from what I've seen.
I think, yeah, just by sheer like ability to process the volume of data that AI can process, that the novelty of information that's going to come out of it is really exciting.
The other part goes back to Joe's personal cryptography and the file that he keeps on his hard drive with his passwords, because it reminded me of a story I saw at Wired.com last week that said that that websites are able to monitor our hard drives. They've got a new way to spy on visitors by measuring subtle interactions with their solid-state hard drives. A technique known as fingerprinting remotely using OPFS-based SSD timing allows sites to monitor other sites a visitor is viewing and what apps are open on their devices. It makes me wonder how, just how secure a hard drive can be from this story, Beth.
Yeah, so this is a new vulnerability, it seems, that folks are talking about. The long name you gave, I think they're using FROST as the acronym for that super technical
yes.
name. But what it's doing is it's exploiting some timing delays in those solid-state hard drives to be able to make guesses about what applications or browser tabs are open at any given time. And then using some algorithms to make some assumptions about what's happening on your computer at the time. So the scary part is that this runs using like normal code that isn't recognized by like a virus scanner or a malware detection software package. It's running behind the scenes in your browser like anything normally would. And people are worried that it may open up some vulnerabilities to, you know, as a new attack vector, that you wouldn't need to actually interact with something in order to trigger a virus or some sort of malicious code to run on your machine. So a little bit scary. The good news is it doesn't look like it's being widely used yet, and it's been discovered before a lot of the vulnerability has come out. So hopefully they can figure out a way to close that that gap before it gets exploited.
Yeah, I think it might have just been a passing story until I saw Meta mentioned as one of the groups caught, you know, potentially using this FROST fingerprinting. Meta, the parent company of Instagram and Facebook and WhatsApp. So this is just initial. Nothing to worry about yet.
Yeah, it's really, you know, right now we all get tracked via cookies.
Right.
And if you turn off your cookies, then, you know, websites like Facebook aren't going to be able to track you as easily. What Facebook is, or Meta is looking to do is get around that by using this Frost method for making predictions about what you're actually doing online instead of seeing it through cookies. So they're just trying to stay a step ahead of people who are trying to keep their information private.
I appreciate that answer, Beth D'Angelo, our guest. And Charlie, thanks for holding on. We'll go to you next in Bloomington, Minnesota.
Yes, I have a question. It's a lot more old-fashioned than AI, but I have an Epson NX430 printer that's 10 to 15 years old, and it does not print consistently for my iPad, which is also somewhat old. It does work most of the time for my iPhone 16. But my iPad, which is older, I can't update that either because it's not enough memory. So some apps don't work on it. But it's just the inconsistency of the printing.
What kind of printer was that, Charlie?
An Epson NX430.
And you said it's how old?
Oh, 10 to 15 years, I'm sure, yeah.
Oh, I really appreciate that. I'd love to have something 10 to 15 years old that's tech. But the question is how, you know, interoperability, interconnectivity, and how long that can last the older your devices get, Beth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the trick here is if this is a printer on a Wi-Fi network, if you're trying to print from your iPad, the frequency that your iPad is connecting to that router may be different from the frequency that your printer is connecting to it at. And most Wi-Fi routers have what's called dual band, so they connect at both frequencies. That can cause some problems if you have your devices not matching on the same frequency. What I would do, and this is a little bit tricky, so you might have to do a couple lookups to figure out how to do it on your specific devices, but make sure that both of those, both your iPad and your printer, are connecting to your wireless router at 2.4 gigahertz frequency so that they can talk to each other rather than at the 5 gigahertz.
2.4 gigahertz, and is that because it's the old connection system
yep.
for wireless?
That's exactly right.
Yeah, Charlie, check and make sure you're both units are operating at 2.4 gigahertz, and that should help with the connectivity, and congratulations for keeping your gear as long as you have. I wish I could. Beth D'Angelo is our guest. We're talking tech today and answering your questions, practical or if it is also theoretical, and both of them seem to hit the spot when it comes to the very latest and some of the very oldest technology. 1-800-642-1234 to join the show or email us talk@WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today. Larry Mueller returns tomorrow from 11 to 1 with a look at the UW Health med flight and the doctor who's taken more than 4,000 patients for treatment on that flight, plus the latest breakthrough in Alzheimer's research and how you can help fight the disease. Right now, we're talking tech with our guest, Beth D'Angelo, Senior IT Specialist at UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. And you can join us at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. Let's go to Stuart in Token Creek next. Stuart, good morning.
Good morning. I have a question. Since Apple is trying to get rid of iTunes, I had iPods over the years, and they last a couple of years and die. I finally got an iPhone 15 a couple of years ago, so I thought I'll start using iTunes and loading my own music. Yeah, first, you have to load it on your laptop and then transfer it to your iPhone. Well, every time you connected, they wanted you to update the software to the point to where, you know, where it doesn't even connect anymore because they're trying to get rid of it. So I was wondering, is there a different music app out there that I could use with my iPhone and my laptop to put my own music on my iPhone?
Ah, Stuart, I'm with you. I do not stream music. I am always uploading shows that I have from my hard drive and PC. Beth, I'd be interested if you have a music app recommendation for us.
Yeah, if you're looking for something to be able to transfer your music that you already own, so that'd be your MP3 files that you have on your hard drive, there's a program called iMazing. That's I-M-A-Z-I-N-G. That's a utility that allows you to you can select what media you want to transfer and move it from your hard drive in the iTunes app into a UI that you can use beyond iTunes. So it's like a copy tool that allows you to do that. And that goes directly on the iOS. That one is probably the best for iPhone for doing it. If you're looking to do it on your laptop, say you had iTunes on your PC, there's a tool called Music Bee. That's Music Bee, all one word. And that's a really nice one for transferring your iTunes music too. You can use like the tagging and organizing stuff similar to what's in iTunes in those tools as well.
Nice. iAmazing and Music Bee ought to make that connection for you. When it comes to a music or media player, I'm always amazed that I use VLC across just about everything, and that is a free software available to use and seems to be about as useful as any media player I've ever had, Beth.
I use VLC quite a bit too. I really like it. It's a great free tool for media files. You don't get as rich of a feature set or as like pretty of a user interface as you do with some of the others. It's a little more like technical looking.
But it's free.
But it's great. Yeah, and it's free.
Yeah. Thank you for the call, Stuart, and the recommendation, Beth. We'll go to Jerry and Kakana next. Jerry, good morning.
Yes, Beth, I bought two new computers because they did not run Windows 11. They were too old. And I got a desktop that the person built for me, and then also have a Lenovo desktop or a laptop, and I can get the printer an old Canon D420 to work on my desktop, but I cannot get it to work from my laptop, and I don't know. I have a burner, a CD drive in my desktop, but I do not have one in my laptop. Any ideas of how I can get it to work on my laptop?
So the PC, Jerry, this was something that you had built for you, but that seems to be connecting just fine. But the Lenovo laptop's the problem. Are you using a wireless connection, or are they all hardwired into a router?
They're all hardwired into a router, and I have a CD drive in the desktop.
Okay, well, that would seem to me then the connection gigahertz frequency would not be an issue here if everything's wired in, Beth.
Yeah, that's probably correct. So if you're directly connected to your internet router and your PC is printing and your laptop isn't, I would want to know if the laptop actually sees the printer when you go to search for new printers and if it tries to install drivers or if it doesn't see it at all. And I'd also like to know, are both of those new machines on Windows 11?
Jerry, let's ask. I imagine both of those are now Windows 11. And have you been able to find that printer when you search for or try to add a printer through the settings?
They're both Windows 11, and it cannot find the printer due to age. I don't think Canon supports the drivers anymore, at least on their website, so I can't find it for the laptop.
Oh, and there's no CD drive for the laptop he would need.
Uh-huh.
Is there a way to use like a thumb drive maybe to get the drivers out of the PC into the laptop, Beth?
So what you could do is you could copy the data that's on the CD to a thumb drive and then use the thumb drive for installation of those drivers on the laptop. Or if you had like a shared drive that you use, or let's say you have like a Google Drive where you can store files on the cloud service, you could copy the installer files from the CD up to that cloud drive and then access it over the internet on your laptop to do the install. You basically just need to get those files onto the laptop, and since you don't have a CD drive, you need another way to move them from the CD onto the hard drive of the computer.
And since Canon seems to insist on planned obsolescence for their printers, you got to find a workaround. But if I would imagine if your Windows 11 desktop is able to do it, there's got to be a way, Jerry, for you to find a way for your Lenovo laptop to get it done. If your desktop can, your laptop should as well. It might just take a few ways to work around. And how would you find that driver for that printer? You'd take it off the CD. It's just a file then, right? You don't have to burn the CD or scan it or anything?
No, there should be an installer and then a whole bunch of supporting files. I would just copy all the files that are on the CD and copy them to another type of media to be able to access them from the laptop. That's one way you could do it. But if you don't have a way to do that, or if that doesn't work, you may be able, there's a site called driverguide.com that might have those drivers that if Canon doesn't. So I would give driverguide.com a try and look up your model of printer for Windows 11 drivers, and they may have it if Canon doesn't.
Oh, that's a great suggestion. I'm writing that down, driverguide.com. And Charlie, who called earlier with his 15 to 20-year-old printer, if all else fails, you may want to try driverguide.com as well. Jerry, thank you for the call, and I hope that helps. Let's go to Maggie in Middleton next. Maggie, good morning.
Good morning. I had something happen to me today that was very sort of disconcerting. I was standing talking with somebody. We're in conversation. I had my cell phone out, and we were setting dates. And so I plugged in the place where I would be volunteering. That's what we're setting dates for. And automatically, my cell phone put up the times that I would be volunteering on the date that I had interest in. It's like it did it for me. It happened once, and I went, oh, that's a coincidence. But we set a second date another time, and it did it again. And I'm wondering, what's going on? The phone is listening to conversations and filling in the dates on my calendar.
Yeah, once might be a coincidence, but twice seems to be some concerted effort on the iPhone. And it is an iPhone, right, Maggie?
Yeah, I got an iPhone 13, I keep it updated.
And is this an Apple calendar that you're using?
Gmail calendar.
Gmail calendar. So it's Apple and it's Google, and somehow they seem to know the times before Maggie can put them in. Beth, what's happening?
Yeah, that is really interesting, and just kind of another point where, you know, people who are saying, I think they're listening to us, that makes you think, yeah, they are listening. But I know that on the Apple products, that Siri, if you have Siri enabled, Siri's always listening. And if Siri hears you talking about dates and times, it may store that information in memory. And then as you go to open an app that's going to record a date or a time, it's going to give you that suggestion automatically. So if you don't want that to happen, I would look to see if you have Siri enabled on your iPhone, and you can disable that if you don't use it.
So you don't actually have to say, hey, and I won't say her name because I don't want to engage for every iPhone user, but you don't actually have to say the hey and then the name of the helper in order to have it actually listening and quote unquote helping you.
I mean, how do you think it hears its name?
But I would think of it to have like a buffer where if it doesn't hear it, it drops that information. But it sounds like in Maggie's instance, it is actually collecting that information and trying to quote unquote help her.
Well, we don't know how long it's keeping that information.
Oh, man. So best advice, turn off Siri. And if Siri's already turned off, then throw your iPhone into the ocean.
So go into all the other apps you have on your phone and turn off the microphone as an accessible device if you don't want it listening to you. So if you go into the settings for each of the apps in your phone, it'll have what parts of your phone that app has access to, and you can switch off the microphone.
And what a wonderful way to wrap up our conversation for June Internet Safety Month, Beth, is a reminder that it's worth our time and money to investigate what settings we have engaged, what notifications we're using, what we're allowing apps and operating systems to do, and to try to figure out a way to limit our personal information and what time we plan to be volunteering and things that we don't want to participate in with the internet and our technology.
Yeah, it's become a lot more complicated than don't talk to strangers.
Oh, man. Yeah, there's a lot more different settings, and they're buried a lot deeper than they used to just be to say no thank you. Beth, I want to thank you as always for your technology advice, your savvy understanding of this complicated world that we are living in. Thank you so much, and happy Internet Safety Month.
Thanks, Lee. Great to talk to you.
Beth D'Angelo's worked in IT for more than 20 years now, and she is a senior IT specialist at UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. When we continue, World Cup starts this week throughout North America, and believe it or not, there are reasons to get your hopes up for the U.S. men's national team. Regardless of the outcome, which you may have seen on Saturday, they start their first game Friday night in Los Angeles, and we've got a preview from the man who arguably knows it best, the author of The Long Game, a new book about the U.S. men's national team, FIFA, and the history of the World Cup. That's when we continue. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Larry Mueller today, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show.